Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the roundtable and webinar on evolving structures and trends for distressed M&A and PE in India post the new bankruptcy code. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vaibhav Parekh. Thank you and over to you, sir.
Thank you and everybody welcome to the our webinar. First of all, my apologies that I am not in Mumbai and I am stuck in Bangalore for some work. But I am participating via video conferencing, so hopefully I will get a chance to meet with each one of you at some point in time. This has been a very, India is going through a very interesting phase. And we have seen that the banking industry in particular and stress assets in particular is creating a lot of danger for Indian economy, but is also creating a lot of opportunity. And we are trying to explore today what is the situation and what are the opportunities and what are the risks associated with this new phase for distressed asset. While going through some of the information in last few months, it seems that Indian NPAs have actually gone way above safe limit. Some of the papers say that Indian NPAs has somewhere around 9% of total loans. Public sector banks are hovering between 12 to 14%. And while the safe limit is more like 4%, many countries like China, Brazil, and other economies have NPAs less than 4%. So India, it is a big threat in one sense, but it also is a big opportunity because we know that Indian government actually will try to now push Indian NPAs more towards 4%, and that will result in a lot of new steps which it will take, which will throw in some opportunities for a lot of activity both on private equity side and on acquisition side. Even before we saw NPAs rise and NPA kind of rose over the last few years ago, Indian NPAs, at least on record, were showing more like 2% to 3%. And when Raghuram Rajan was the RBI governor, he kind of addressed this issue because it seemed to him that banks were actually dressing up NPAs more like like an active loan or evergreening the NPAs rather than taking the NPAs head on. And because of it, the numbers look pretty good, but in reality, things may not have been very good. Continuing from that perspective, Indian NPAs have risen quite a bit. And already several ARCs saw this as an opportunity and became very active. There are several examples which shows ARCs grabbing some of the loans at a very attractive price and some of the companies at an attractive price trying to take benefit of the stress situation which exists at that point in time. However, when you look at some of the reports and when you see some of the results, it seems that they have not been completely successful. And when I was reviewing some of those statements, what I found is a lot of blame came to Indian legal system, because even though one would like try to go and have a SARFAESI applied to a particular asset to recover the asset, there are enough ways to stall it. A lot of people used to use BIFR mechanism to delay and otherwise frustrate some of the recovery process. After which, the new insolvency bill, which has act which has come in, has created a very a unique and interesting chapter in Indian legal scenario. One, they have brought in what is equivalent to Chapter 11, and also the resolution or the winding up process has become slightly easier. As a result, now the opportunity not just have increased, but also because of the new law, there have been a hope at least that the legal obstacle will to some extent get minimized. Now with every law, and especially new law, there are always challenges. There are teething troubles, there are issues which one doesn't understand, and there are benefits which law brings in. So we believe that it will be an exciting time in this space, and specifically, of course, this insolvency law, we will see a lot more activities in this particular space. With this, I would like to spend some time asking our panelists questions on some of the legal situations and add their experience in this particular space to highlight opportunities, risk, and liabilities to the audience. Let me start with Simon. Simon, what is the process involved in filing for a bankruptcy under the code? Sorry, Simon, sorry for interruption. Can you unmute from BKC? I can't hear. I think the audience may be able to hear, but I can't hear.
So like I said, I think the insolvency code recognizes three categories of individuals. One is financial creditors, the second and the third is the corporate debtor itself. So each of these have the ability to file or entertain a petition under the insolvency code. For the purposes of this webinar, I think we will deal with only financial creditors because otherwise the process may be a little bit complicated. So a financial creditor today includes any kind of financial creditor, both secured and unsecured. And a financial creditor specifically is anyone to whom a debt is owed, right, whether it's disputed or not. And it's important to make that distinction because there are certain privileges or certain benefits to being a financial creditor vis-a-vis an operational creditor, in which the question of what is a dispute comes into question. So a financial creditor, all begins with a financial creditor making an application before the NCLT. If there is a default that has been committed on its on the financial loan. Now, in terms of the financial debt, it doesn't really make a difference whether it's financial debt or somebody else's financial debt. As long as there is a default on a financial debt, the financial creditor can make an application before the NCLT. This application needs to be admitted or rejected by the adjudicating authority, which is the NCLT, within 14 days. So the entire NCLT insolvency court process is very time-bound. At the outset, overall, this process must be completed within 180 days from the date on which the process commences. That 180 days can be extended only once and up to a maximum of 90 days. So the total process will be 270 days before which this entire process must be concluded. If the process is not concluded within that time, the NCLT will have to pass an order in terms of liquidating the company or following the liquidation process thereafter. So it all starts in the beginning where a financial creditor makes an application for the NCLT alleging the default in terms of and starting the process under the insolvency code. The NCLT needs to look at this within 14 days and satisfy itself that there is an existing financial debt and there is a default. Once the NCLT is satisfied, it can either admit the default and admit the petition, or it can reject it if the application is not complete. If the application is not complete, it can give the party 7 days to rectify the application, pursuant to which it can again admit that default. Once the petition has been admitted, the insolvency process is deemed to have been commenced. So all timelines relate to the date on which the petition is actually admitted. Once the petition is admitted, there are three sort of main orders that the adjudicating authority needs to pass. The first one is the order of a public notice. The second one is in no particular order. And the third is to appoint the insolvency resolution professional. Now, the insolvency resolution professional must be appointed within 14 days again of the petition being admitted. The moratorium period means that there will be a moratorium over all other cases and disputes and other judgments and suits, and we will deal with what that means in a bit later, but there is a moratorium so that the company and the creditors are able to sort of, you know, deal with the issue at hand. Now, there has been a lot of back and forth on what that moratorium means, whether you can have other actions, you know, alongside, and there have been cases, there have been sort of concerns on what really can be done with respect to that moratorium period, which we will deal with later. And the first aspect is the publication, so that you have all claims, so that the insolvency resolution professional has the ability to access all claims that would be due and need to be dealt with in this process. The publication needs to have a list of items, including when the claims must be handed over to the IRB. Once this happens, once the IRB has been appointed, the committee of creditors needs to be appointed. Now, the committee of creditors plays a very important role because it is this committee that decides or votes on the resolution that will be adopted by the company, and decides the fate of the company thereafter. This committee is comprised only of financial creditors and not of operational creditors. Financial creditors, again, both secured as well as unsecured, but it comprises only of financial creditors. The meetings of these creditors can be attended by operational creditors, a representative of an operational creditor. It can also be attended by the erstwhile board of directors and the management of the company, but they don't have a voting power in that committee. They only have the right to attend. All decisions of this committee are decided by voting share, and it has to be decided by voting share of 75%. Any decision is made by an affirmative vote of 75% of the voting share in value. Once the committee has been constituted, the committee, the entire management of the company vests with the IRB, but the committee has to decide whether the original IRB, which is an interim resolution professional, continues as the actual resolution professional, or they want to change that professional. If they want to change that professional, they need to again go back to the NCLT, and the NCLT may require the sanction of the board to propose an IRB, but this is a process, this is a right given to the committee of creditors. Once this process has been crystallized, the entire role of the committee of creditors as well as the IRB is to form a resolution plan and to approve a resolution plan. All of this must be done within 180 days, extendable maximum to 270 days, upon which it must be given to the NCLT. The resolution plan, again, is something that has been that gets created by a resolution applicant and doesn't have to be done by the IRP. But the IRP needs to verify that it complies with the provisions of the insolvency code and takes care of the interests of the various stakeholders at hand. Once this plan has been okayed by the IRP, it is put to vote by the Committee of Creditors, and the Committee of Creditors, by 75% voting share, needs to approve of it, pursuant to which it is given to the NCLT for final sanction. Once that happens, that becomes binding on all stakeholders involved in the company, including those that have not voted in favor. There are certain remedies that can be given to those that have not voted in favor, but by and large, this plan is binding on all stakeholders. If the plan cannot be reached, if the plan contradicts with how the insolvency code requires for it to be, or the plan is for in fact liquidation of the company, the NCLT then will proceed with the liquidation of the company in the manner set out in the code. So in a nutshell, this is the process that needs to be followed by in connection with the code, and this is how the bankruptcy process or the resolution process actually is undertaken.
Thank you, Simon. I think this sounds very interesting. We see a lot of new things which have come up in this particular code. But what we want to know, and I think I will ask this question to Vyapak. Vyapak, can you tell us how has bankruptcy code changed things for lenders, right, and acquirers and companies?
Sure.
And what was the situation before the bankruptcy code came into picture?
Sure. So, yes, I think, one, of course, we heard from Simon as to how the process of insolvency in particular will work going forward, right? But just to bring the context as to where things were, and some of those things may be still relevant, some of those things may not be relevant, and how it would still interplay, or if I may use the word overlap, as far as the insolvency code is concerned, across different laws, across different regulations, and also some of this, very interestingly, in less than 9 months, have come up before the courts already, right up to the Supreme Court, and some of these things have been clarified. Some of these things are in the process of getting clarified, but it's definitely pretty important to understand that how this overlap or how this conflicts across various laws which were earlier existing and which would still continue to exist in some form or the other. So taking a little step back, what was the regime when nothing of this laws, including the CICA, BIFR, and we'll talk about it, the DRD, what were the remedies for a lender, right? Technically, there were only two remedies. One is if you have lended some money to the borrower, either you go and recover from a court, because you have always the remedy to go to an appropriate court to recover your money, or if your contract has an arbitration clause, then obviously you invoke the arbitration and crystallize your debt. But that was not in form of any restructuring. It was more of an individual recovery process. So that was something which is not envisaged as per the insolvency code. So we should not confuse that this is in any way a mode of recovery. Insolvency process and restructuring process is a purely a process which is outside the scope of the recovery, because that's not the forum to recover your money. So that process still continues, and one needs to decide as and when there is a default as to whether you want to go the recovery route, which still continues between the courts and the arbitration, or you want to go through the insolvency code. Earlier, when the insolvency code was not there, we had only thing we had was Companies Act. So Companies Act still continues to have those remedies. One is, of course, your restructuring remedies under the Companies Act. So you still continue to have provisions for amalgamations or restructuring or what we call a scheme of arrangements, which was a privately agreed agreement between the creditors or the shareholders and the promoters of the company, approved in the form and manner allowed under the Companies Act. So that remedy still continues. You can always come up with a scheme of arrangement without going into the statutory regime, because as Simon mentioned, the moment you apply, within 14 days a lot happens. There is a moratorium, there is a suspension of board of directors powers, and basically you are turning the company upside down before it gets restructured. So the scheme of arrangement route is still available. And yes, there may be some overlap between this and that, but it is something which is still, which you can do privately. The other remedy available under the Companies Act was the winding up, and some portion of it in terms of the debt, the 433E, as we used to always, cite, has now completely gone under the insolvency code. So that is where I think the provisions of the Companies Act are now almost shifted so far as insolvency code, but with a very, very different purpose. Earlier, when you used to go to court and apply for winding up, which of course is not a recovery, the court used to do a two-stage process. One, they used to first decide whether there is a disputed debt or an admitted debt. That in itself used to take 2, 3, 4 years to even determine, because of the court process, things used to work and appeals and, stuff. And even after decision that yes, the debt is due, it was incumbent upon the courts to decide whether it is still in public interest to wind up a company. Yes, this company is not able to pay debt, but in public interest, this company should not be wound up. So there were judgments both ways, where it was in public interest to wind up, but the whole process used to take 7, 8, 10 years. And this in itself was not combined with restructuring. So there was no scope of restructuring as part of winding up. While insolvency code now combines these two processes, which was never available as part of a composite scheme, where you either resolve and restructure or you go for winding up. So this is where I think the code brings, I would say, a radical change with a time-bound program as to how you either restructure or you go for winding up. Now, of course, some of these provisions were available in different forms and in different forums earlier. And in fact, that was the bigger problem. Not that those reliefs or those remedies were not available. So what Indian legislature did in earlier years is first they brought in something called SICA and BIFR, Sikh Industrial Company Act, which is akin to a provision where a corporate debtor himself can go for restructuring, though it was mandated under SICA that if you lose your 100% of the network, you are mandated to go for restructuring. And you get the moratorium under the SICA the moment you are registered with BIFR. But that was more misused than used. And that is what is also documented in many law commission reports. So you have now third forum. We talked about courts slash arbitration depending upon the contract. Second was your winding up. And the third forum was created in form of BIFR, where people used to go to misuse it to get the moratorium around the remaining suits or recoveries pending, rather than use it as a restructuring platform. When that was also not working, suddenly at that point in time, I think RBI and I'm sure the other stakeholders realized that all these forums are very generalized. Everyone comes there. What we need is a specialized forum for recovery for banks. That's where in 1992 we had DRT. And everyone thought that, okay, this is end of all problems for the banks. Because now you have a DRT, which is a summary process. In 2 years, you will have a recovery certificate and get your use cleared. This still continues, by the way. There is no change so far as DRT is concerned. So far as banks and financial institutions are concerned, which today all of them are under the NCLT insolvency code, they had this summary remedy for recovery since 1992. That again failed as a matter of process and execution. And that is where we got success. Where they said, look, if you are a secured creditor and if 75% of you agree, you you don't have to even go to DRT. You don't have to go to COA. You straight away go and take your asset. This came 15 years back, 2002. That still continues, right? But even to some extent it has failed because nobody wants to take over the asset, and what would bank do by taking over the asset? Of course, SurfaceA is now extended to even NBFCs beyond certain asset value, I think 500 crores, and some other specific institutions, housing companies and things like that. But that was primarily done for banking and financial institutions, having more than 75% strength as a secured creditor group. So that still continues. In between that, we obviously got RBI to look at joint lending forums created under the CDR broader mechanism, which still is under process. So all of this is there, and everything is something which is available. Still, I think RBI came up with an ordinance in 2017 after 6 months of insolvency picture that forget about all of this. Why don't you go to insolvency court? And that shows the importance and the focus on the insolvency court as to why this court is so unique in the sense that it gives you something which is a combination of the best balance between restructure or retire. You know, you can't continue this process ever long. And therefore, this is where insolvency code comes into picture. And some of these aspects, which I think as a strategy, when you advise a borrower or advise a lender, I think some of these processes are still available. It's not that everything gets into insolvency code, but, and if that happens, I think even this system would fail, because I don't think the NCLTs would be able to manage the kind of workload if people straight away go to insolvency court for every remedy. And I don't think that's always the right remedy. And more importantly, why it is not the right remedy every time? Because there are statutory implications of going to insolvency court. One, you have very limited time to act, which means there is not too much of leeway. And in restructuring and in business, you obviously want that leeway as well. Two, the management and board of directors lose complete rights over the business. And now you are relying upon an IRP to run the business. Now, coming to IRP, it's again a great step, because earlier what used to happen? If you go to BIFR, of course, there was no management change. But if you go to winding up and a provisional liquidator is appointed, it is like a government person taking over the business. Here, at least, you are having a professional IRPs who are either lawyers, chartered accountants, company secretaries, maybe engineers. A lot of that will be now available as a completely new pool of experts to run your business. So it's a good thing to do, but still, they don't have the history of running that business. So there is always a problem of getting an IRP versus going under different roofs. And two, if you don't complete your process under 180 days, you have no option but to go under the insolvency, because that's almost like a fallout as a mandate post the non-approval of the plan within 180 days, maximum to 270 days. So I think, yes, as Vaibo initially mentioned, in our view, the most exciting times as far as the combination of the corporate restructuring versus disputes are concerned, but one has to really weigh a balance as to which way you want to go. And maybe as we proceed, I think we'll also discuss some of the very interesting judgments which have already come in less than 12 months, right up to the Supreme Court. And in fact, the way the government is functioning, and it's a laudable effort, that in less than 9 months they have even come up with ordinance amending the act itself. Now one may say, why didn't you even get your act right in the first place? That's one way of looking at it. But I think the second way and more positive way of looking at it, look, whenever a new thing is implemented, you will always find problems as you go along. But if you act swiftly, like what this government is doing, I think the at least the intentions look positive. And in fact, today, I don't know how much of you realize, but while you may be on your way for this conference, there is an ordinance already issued amending several provisions of the Act, particularly in relation to who can be the bidder, because that was the biggest debate happening in the last 2 weeks. And they came up with the answer very quickly, and this is the right time, because as you would know, sometime in June, about 12 accounts were directed to go under the insolvency code. So the 180 days are just about to get over, and the bidding process is at the, you know, the best time in that sense. So this is the time when they had to act and they have acted. Whether it is again right, wrong, we'll debate during the course of this conference. But I think that is something which also we'll discuss over a, over this 1 hour.
Yeah, and it's important to know that the ordinance, you know, has also cleverly captured the fact. Two things. One is they said that no promoter who has been a willful reporter. So they balanced the wants of the promoter, who is a genuine concern or genuine promoter who wants another sort of another niche to run his company, versus a willful reporter. And personally, so they sort of try to, you know, tackle the mischief by saying not only the promoter, persons connected to the promoter are also sort of barred. But the second that they mischief is this perspective, is it applicable prospectively, what is the applicability of the ordinance? And it cleverly sort of, you know, stated that this applies, you know, even if the resolution plan has not been adopted. So even if you're on your way and the resolution plan has not been adopted, the insolvency petition has been admitted, it doesn't make a difference. Even if the bids have already gone, no IRP can conclude unless and until, you know, this ordinance is taken. So it's not, the question of if it's prospectively or not retrospective has been clear. That mischief has also been clear. The text of the ordinance is still awaited, specifically, but these are the summary of the text of the ordinance.
Thank you, Vyapak, and thank you, Simon. It's good to know that the government is very responsive and tried to plug the loopholes which could have made possible mockery of the insolvency process. But there may be more such loopholes, and I think over a period of time we will see how government reacts and how the court reacts. And that's why this is going to be what we call a living act, and things will keep on changing. And in this situation, we need to understand how do we acquire asset or invest in a company which is in this process. So now let me go to Nishal and ask him what kind of structure you can use, you know, different structures which you can use to acquire assets or invest in this company. Given this code and given the way things are happening over a period of, including the change which is regularly happening.
Sure. Thanks, Vaibhav. So I think, as Vyapak mentioned, you know, a lot of these 12 accounts are in the process of getting bids from the acquirers on the resolution. In fact, we are working with some of the bidders who have evinced interest in acquiring some of the assets. And not only structuring, but even how do you conduct due diligence in these type of situation, how do you structure documentation, how do you negotiate with a promoter who hardly has anything to give to you in terms of indemnity or absent warranties. I think these things become very important in distressed M&A type of situation. So let me start with the first phase on how do you negotiate the non-disclosure agreement or the exclusivity agreement, because everything is different from a normal M&A deal in a distressed M&A deal. I think the most important thing when you are negotiating NDA in a normal deal would be the seller would want the obligation on the buyer that you cannot share any information with anybody, whatever is shared with you with respect to the company. And the information has to be restricted to you and your legal advisor. Now, in a distressed M&A deal or in a deal where, let's say, the company is already under the insolvency process, you have to have a carve-out to negotiate with the lenders, because you cannot negotiate with the seller without negotiating with the lenders. Lenders are not going to allow the seller or the promoter to take away his buy without, you know, their loan being repaid. So you need to get this carve out in your non-disclosure agreement and exclusivity agreements, where you are able to negotiate with other stakeholders also in the company, and not just with the seller. I think the second important piece which comes up is on the due diligence. And again, due diligence becomes important, especially for large accounts which have been referred by RBI, because a lot of them are listed companies. Now, on one hand, we are talking about a distressed situation where the ability to get reps and warranties or indemnity will almost be nil or negligible. On the other hand, we also have insider trading regulations from SEBI, which does not allow an acquirer to get any price-sensitive information about the company unless the same information is disclosed to public at large. So how do you manage these two contradictory objectives? Because on one hand, you are putting in your money in a company which is like a black hole. On the other hand, laws do not allow you to get any information from the company. So this is one major which comes up where you are looking at acquiring the listed company shares, and how do you handle the insider trading regulations. Some of the other things which become critical from a due diligence perspective when you are looking at distressed companies, I think one would be obviously the ability of any lender to convert loan into equity, because if you are looking at acquiring 100% equity, but there is a right with the lender to convert this portion into equity, then you are diluting your stake, which needs to be taken care of. Second important thing is if you are getting any indemnity or reps and warranties from the promoter of the distressed company, then obviously you need to see the financial wherewithal of the promoter and whether promoter himself is a guarantor in some of these situations where if the loan is not repaid, then, you know, the promoter himself will have to repay, in which case if he is taking on any indemnity obligation, he may not have anything left because the lenders would take away, you know, whatever is left with him. So that's another important provision which needs to be looked at. I think the third important thing, and obviously the litigations, given that the company is in distress, there will be a number of litigations which would be there against the company from the lender side. Maybe the company would have defaulted on payments to the suppliers. So what are the terms of the supply contracts where, you know, is there any requirement where, you know, in some of the exclusive supply contracts where there's a large supplier, also typically asks for change in control type of clauses, which means that in case in a distressed situation as an acquirer, you're looking for acquiring these companies, then you may also need to take supplier's consent before, you know, changing the control of the company. I think the other important thing would also be what are the qualifications which have been made in the audit report. Because typically the auditors will make qualifications in the audit reports in these situations. And most important of that would be you would definitely won't want to miss the contingent liability section in the annual report, because lots of impending liabilities would be covered in the annual report and you need to factor that in the valuation before you are, you know, bidding for the asset. Another important aspect from a due diligence perspective would be, as you know, in India we have thousands of laws and each law will have both civil and criminal liability attached to any violation. Now, if there is any violation which has been done by the company, typically the board of directors are liable for that. Now, when you are looking at a change in control of the company and as an acquirer you want to replace the existing board with your board, would the new board be settled with the liability for the violations which have been done in the past? And, you know, almost all legislations in India have criminal liability for sometimes for very minor defaults. Which is why this becomes important on the directors who are taking over the distressed company. There is no immunity which is provided under any provision of the Companies Act or any legislation. So due diligence becomes extremely important when you are looking at these type of companies. From a structuring perspective, there are many structures which can be used, and typically in a distressed type of situation, the wisest thing to do would be to use a debt instrument to, you know, to invest in the company so that you are able to extract the economics out in a situation where the company turns around it's easy to get your money back as compared to just, you know, investing in equity. Because typically in a distressed situation, there will be losses in the company. And as you know, under Companies Act, if you are holding an equity instrument, dividend cannot be paid without the company having profits. So even if the company turns around from loss to a break-even situation, company sitting on cash flows, but because it doesn't have profit, there can't be any dividend which can be paid. So it's advisable to use a debt instrument, and debt can come in various forms. You can use an optionally convertible debenture, a non-convertible debenture, and sometimes even a compulsorily convertible debenture. Now, what are the types of acquirers which would typically be interested? Globally, there have always been three types of acquirers. One is the insiders or the promoters who themselves may want to acquire their company, which as per today's ordinances, somewhere, the government has blocked that, partially. Then you have a strategic acquirers who are interested in, consolidating their assets by acquiring the competitors. And you have financial acquirers like the special situation funds who are looking at making money out of distressed situation because the assets are available cheap, valuations are cheap. And because the company is in distress, they take the risk of investing in the company with the hope of getting higher returns. Now, for financial acquirers, what we have seen is there are three or four ways in which they typically look at acquiring these companies. One is, direct acquisition of equity. So sometimes they partner with strategic acquirers where they just acquire shares of the company, either take a minority stake or if it's a buyout fund which is aggressive on turning around companies, they can also take a majority stake. We also have structures where alternative investment funds can be used, where a foreign investor can just pump in money in an AIF, and AIF can then invest in the form of debentures in the Indian stressed or distressed company. And the benefit of this is the flexibility of the instrument. If you are using an AIF, if the AIF is, whether it is Indian-owned or controlled or foreign-owned or controlled, AIF has the flexibility to invest in non-convertible debenture or optionally convertible debenture. So this itself is a huge benefit because you can extract the economics out of the company through the debentures by structuring the terms of debentures in a manner where you are able to sometimes even structure equity type of returns on the debentures. Then you can also use an NBFC structure if, the foreign special situation fund as an NBFC within the group in India. That NBFC can also be used to refinance the loan. So the NBFC can give a loan at a very high interest to the portfolio company, to the company, which can be back-ended so that for first few years the interest rate is very low and then you make it up in future years when the company turns around and is making profit. That's another model, and a non-convertible debenture directly from foreign investor is also something that can be used. Now, what are the issues which could come up in terms of structuring? I think especially in distress situation, tax is the biggest issue, because there are multiple sections under the Income Tax Act which would get impacted. The first one is there's a Section 79 of Income Tax Act where if the distressed company is a private company, then there is a provision, and let's say the distressed company has huge accumulated tax losses. There is a provision that if more than 49% of shareholding of that company changes, then all the tax losses lapse, which means that, the entire benefit which the company would have got when it would have turned around, it would have been able to offset the tax losses against the profits in future years. That entire benefit gets lost because of the change in control type of situation. So this is one major issue which needs to be dealt with. We have dealt with this situation. We recently did one CDR deal for one of the clients where instead of pumping in money in the form of equity, we pumped in money in the form of equity up to 48.99%. And rest of the money went as compulsorily convertible preference shares. Because it went as CCPS, it didn't result in change in equity shareholding of the company. And the way we arranged the terms of the CCPS was that the CCPS convert into equity in the years in which the tax losses are lapsing. So the 8-year period was lapsing, for example, in 2018-19, then CCPS will, let's say, convert in 19-20. That way, we managed to ensure that, you know, the tax losses do not lapse in the company. Second situation, the new draconian section which has been introduced by this year's budget is section 50CA, which what it says is that any transfer of shares which happens of an Indian company has to be at fair value. Now, in all distressed companies, we all know that, you know, especially the ones which are listed, the ruling market price may be substantially low as compared to the intrinsic value in the company, because the promoters may not have written off the book value of the assets. So what happens in a situation where 50 rupee is the intrinsic or NAV of the company, but market price is only 10 rupees per share? Now, any buyer is going to buy at 10 rupees or somewhere close to that. Now, the moment the transaction happens at 10 rupees, from a tax perspective, what the tax department says is that the transfer will be deemed to have happened at 50 rupees. And that's how the methodology is calculated. There is an NAV formula which is given, which talks about you have to go through the book value and sometimes even the market value of the underlying assets. So your land may be appearing in the books of the company at $100, but if the reckoner value of the land as per stamp purpose is 1,000 rupees, 1,000 will be considered. So this is a huge issue which, you know, we are facing in stress deals, because the actual real value is always lower than the book value of the assets in the company. Same thing is section 56, which is from a buyer perspective, where the book value is 50 and seller is selling at 10. The difference between book value and the price at which transaction happens is considered as income for the buyer, which is taxed at 33%. That's another issue. The other issue from a borrower perspective is that in all the deals where you know, there is a haircut, what happens is that there will always be some difference in the value which is reflected in the books and the value which the lender is taking out. So let's say there is a 10,000 crore loan from a lender and the haircut is agreed at 6,000 crore. So the lender is going to get back only 4,000 crore. Now, what is the treatment of 6,000 crore in the books of the borrower? Because for the borrower, this will become an income. The moment he writes off 10 to 4, the entry for 6,000 crore has to go to the credit side of P&L account. Now, the borrower is already suffering. On top of that, there is a haircut which has come, which goes to credit side of P&L account. On that, there could be a potential tax of another 33%, because he's saving the amount by not being required to repay that amount. So this is another issue on haircut, whether there will be a tax on the haircut or not. One view is that if that entire loan was used for working capital purposes, when you write back the loan amount, it will be taxable. But if it was used for capital expansion, then any write back should not result in any tax issue. That's for normal tax, but there is also a MAT angle to it. When you credit something to a P&L account, a MAT is applicable. And whether once it is credited to P&L account, whether the tax department will come back and say whether MAT is applicable or not is a question. Recently in JSW steel case, Mumbai tribunal ruled that MAT should not be applicable in these situations, but it's a gray area and one needs to watch out for this. If you are acquiring shares of a listed company, then there is a takeover code exemption which has been specifically provided, where you don't need to make an open offer if you are acquiring more than 25% of the controlling stake in the company. Unfortunately, under competition law, there is no exemption which has been provided to an acquirer who is acquiring these assets. Now, what happens is that you have this 270-day process during which the insolvency resolution process has to get over. Now, we are in a situation where, as Vyapak mentioned, January is the time when 6 months get over for this 12 accounts. The bids will start flowing in, you know, next week or, you know, for the next 30 days. Now, let's say the creditors committee and IRP, they identify one potential acquirer. Now, if that acquirer does not get an exemption under competition commission, so in most, because these 12 cases, 12 companies are so huge, they will meet with all the assets and, you know, turnover thresholds under competition act.
So there will be a requirement to go to CCI. Then you are talking about 2 more months to close the transaction. Now this is a situation where every day loss is depleting the value of the company. And you have to again wait for 2 more months to get the CCI approval. This could create, you know, a lot of issues. And one thing which may also come up is whether once the 270-day period expires, whether the moratorium itself would lapse, in which case the acquirer could be at a disadvantage because then there could be other types of issues which could come up from other litigants. And I think the last is on the, obviously you'll have to look at the exchange control and sectoral cap related things, if, depending on in which sector the target is. But broadly, I think these are 3 or 4 things from a structuring, due diligence and negotiation perspective, which one needs to take care of. Another point which is important is when you are negotiating the deal with the seller, let's say he's selling some of his assets, I think you need to be careful about the successor liability issue. So maybe there is no liability on that day, seller is waiving everything. But there are a lot of legislations in India where there is a concept of successor liability which passes on to the buyer by law. So if it is passing on to the buyer by law, then, and if the seller is wherewithal to honor that in case that liability comes up, then there is an additional liability which the buyer is taking up, which needs to be taken care of. And I think last one, which I think Vyapak will deal with later, but I think one of the most important things, you know, as an advisor to client who is acquiring assets and distress deal, is we have to be very careful to ensure that how do you ensure that the transaction which you are doing is not unwound, right? You have done the transaction, and after doing the transaction, if there is some court order where, you know, moratorium expires, is there any risk of the transaction being unwound by the court, where the court comes back and says this was not properly done, IRP exceeded the authority which was given to the to IRP, a committee of creditors didn't act properly, the creditors were somewhere found out to be related parties of the promoter. All these issues, whether there is a possibility of the transaction being unwound, is something that needs to be looked into.
Thank you, Nishal. That reminds me, you know, when you were talking about tax issue, it reminded me of one transaction which I was involved recently. It was a very interesting situation. It was a non-Indian parent which had an Indian subsidiary, and Indian subsidiary was not doing pretty good. In fact, Indian business was not doing pretty good. It has had a lot of losses, and to an extent that there was a loan from a parent to the subsidiary, which was outstanding in the book, which they could not access. Closed down the company. The management came and said, look, I want to buy out the company. They believe that there is a business which is there. As long as you write off the loan, which means that the business won't be viable if the loan is still outstanding, but if you kind of write off the loan, we will buy out the company. And again, this was for a very negligible company. Interestingly, we tried to find a way to write off a loan and still make it a viable proposition for the management to buy out. As we shared, what we found out, that if you write off the loan, it will be a profit in the books of the company, the write-off amount, which was quite sizable. And while there was a loss to kind of adjust against the profit, the math issue would make this whole proposal unviable, because if MAT is to be paid and then later on adjusted for the future profits, assuming future profits come, there's an immediate cash flow which becomes an issue. And at the end of the day, because of this reason, we actually had to structure this as an asset purchase and then go for the winding up of the company, which is inefficient and a long-run process. But the only way it can work because of the problem, the tax side which we just discussed. It also reminded me of a second deal which I had worked on, which was interesting. It's a listed entity in a, you know, medical space, which was in distress, had gone through CDR route, just come out of CDR route. There was a bidder who thought that they would want to take, they would want to invest in this company, and would want to take some, you know, they believed in that certain business of it, but didn't want to participate in all the CDR and the other issues which the company was going through. So what we did was we demerged the company, the business of the company, medical business of the company, into a private company and got investment into that company. And that company now actually is doing very well, is very profitable, and it has created more value for the parent than any other business put together. So these are some good examples where, you know, you've seen how do you structure your, you know, how do you structure for, you know, in making investment or acquiring company. Now, but again, Nishal has identified a lot of issues already, and I would like to turn to Simone and ask her concerns on bankruptcy code and what stakeholders should be wary about.
Thanks, Ego. So I think the entire sort of code puts incentives on the IRP, and I think that is the most important sort of organ for this code to run as it's supposed to be. Now, the IRP could be an individual, could be a body corporate, could be a firm, but the level of expertise that is demanded of such an individual may not be really found in the Indian market as we stand. And therefore, we see that there's a dearth of IRP is really, and everyone and anyone today is willing to be an IRP, but may not really have the financial wherewithal or the knowledge to run this company. Now, if you see legislation like the U.S., so we'll talk about it in a bit, but you know, the management does play a very important role in how this company is turned around. And therefore, also gives impetus to the management to cooperate because it is sure that it will not really be displaced. In the Indian bankruptcy code scenario, you have the IRP that exercises all powers of the management, exercises all powers of the board of directors. And therefore, it's a very sort of, you know, there's a huge relationship issue, there's a huge responsibility of the IRP, and the management may not really be found welcome in how the IRP really manages the company. And therefore, there could be a tussle between what the management can or cannot do and how it cooperates with the IRP and how the IRP takes advice from the management, especially because the management can even be displaced as a result of the resolution. And therefore, there is sort of like a tussle in terms of how this company is really going to be turned around. Because as we started off saying, the intent of the restructuring process is to actually restructure and not necessarily just sell off the asset and wind up the company. Right? There are two ways to really wind up a company. One is you wind it up with the entire company, or you sell part of its assets and change the way it runs business. And the intent of the code and the intent of this entire self-insolvency code was to predict the stress level of the company and help it to, you know, to actually come out of stress as opposed to necessarily selling off the assets of the company. So therein sort of lies a tussle in terms of how the IRP can actually manage this entire company. The second bit is it's good in a way, because I think even the Securities Exchange Board of India is moving towards this, that the promoters are quite left out of the entire process. And I'll divide it between the promoters as well as and the representatives of the company. Because even if you see the entire resolution process, it does not involve any representative of the company, doesn't resolve any representative of the company, of the promoters either, of the controlling shareholders in decision making. Now, I mean, the flip side is that this court does not require the promoters, for instance, to give any of the assets or contribute to the restructuring process. If you saw the CDR, the JLX sort of requirements, all of them, you know, predicted or required for the promoters to contribute either by way of equity or otherwise in the entire resolution process. And this code does not require for that to happen. So on the one hand, the promoter is actually absolved from really taking the onus of resolving or putting this company through. On the other hand, it is not represented at all in how the resolution process needs to be addressed. Of course, practically, you may always need to involve the promoter and the company because that's how you will get the best outcome in terms of how the company should or can be run. But therein lies some sort of a concern that perhaps needs to be looked at. Now, whilst the moratorium as well is on the company and suits against the company, it does not prohibit, however, lender from suing or enforcing security interests that it might have created on promoter assets, for instance, the promoter guarantee or promoter assets. So even though there is a resolution process for the company, and technically the promoter doesn't really need to give or doesn't really need to contribute to the resolution process, had the promoter given a security interest, the creditor could also sort of claim against that security. I think the third aspect that you need to be aware of is the entire process that the once you've admitted that petition, you know, will follow its process as prescribed under the code. And it no longer enables you to withdraw from a suit from or withdraw an admitted petition from CMPL. This has gone up to the Supreme Court as to whether a creditor should be able to settle amongst themselves to remove the petition from admission to bankruptcy or not. But I think the way the Supreme Court and the NCLT and the NCLAT have actually looked at this is that this entire code is supposed to be a restructuring code. It's not supposed to be used as a bargaining chip, saying that, you know, if you don't do this, I will go ahead and file for liquidation, which often used to be the case in under the previous measure, where you would say, okay, I will file a voluntary liquidation or I will file a liquidation petition and see how the company would react. The intent is for there actually to be an intent to restructure, and therefore you need to be sort of wary as to where you're going with this petition. So once it has been admitted, as the law stands today and as the Supreme Court has held, there is no real ability for the NCLT to allow for a petition to be withdrawn or for the NCLAT, which is the appellate authority, to allow for that petition to be withdrawn. Having said that, the Supreme Court, however, has retained powers under the Constitution to obtain such a situation, and perhaps we'll look at it on a case-to-case basis to see whether or not in the interest of justice this ability to sort of withdraw can be exercised. What that also means is that should you want to withdraw and should you arrive at a settlement, you really need to go to the Supreme Court to get this sort of resolved. So it could be a long wait there. I think the third sort of concern or issue that we've seen is the entire NCLT process. Now, the NCLT, is a tribunal that is currently quite overburdened, because not only does it have to deal with, you know, bankruptcy and insolvency, it also has to deal with, you know, various aspects of company's law as well as merger issues. So it is extremely sort of overburdened. Not only is it overburdened, the question of, you know, expertise also comes into question. Now, the NCLT is a new tribunal. You have, you know, although the Companies Act, mergers, acquisitions, etc. have been there for a while, the individuals that are now responsible or taking charge of these positions are individuals that have never dealt with these aspects before. And therefore, understanding what a merger is, understanding what an amalgamation is itself takes time. Now, with that, you have a new law and completely, you know, a strong powers to sort of restructure an entire company. That in itself, again, you know, it needs to be looked at very carefully, and how the NCLT, situation, especially in a time-bound law, is again a concern. We have been sort of delays and a lot of a lot of issues as to how overburdened PNC really is. I think the fourth concern or issue is the fact that, you know, secured creditors as well as unsecured creditors are looked at as one bucket. And therefore, even if you have a secured interest, technically speaking, and you don't have 75% of that of the entire financial debt, you have the ability to, or the resolution plan that has been adopted by the creditors will be binding on you. What the law also provides for, however, is some sort of exemption, wherein if you know, a secured creditor has not sent it to the resolution plan, or you can't really make a, you have to take into consideration that secured creditor before you make a payout to any unsecured creditor. So there are certain checks and balances for a dissenting creditor, but again, that needs to be taken into consideration when looking at an asset. I think the third aspect, the last aspect, is the fact that today, you know, even in the committee of creditors, especially because it is sum of financial of unsecured plus secured creditors. Unsecured creditors can also include related parties, and more often than not, the unsecured creditors are often the related parties. Now, the code does try to prevent that mischief by saying that a related party will not be able to vote. However, nothing prevents a related party from transferring that debt to another individual who is not another entity that is not a related party. And that new creditor has the same rights that a general creditor would have in that situation. Now, this has come about, this question of whether you can assign, you know, after the petition has been admitted, you can assign before the petition has been admitted, has been debated before court. And it looks like the view of the court is that that's an internal creditor matter. And the entire aspect of restructuring these creditors vis-a-vis departments. And the code currently does not sort of prohibit that specifically, and therefore their entire mischief can be exercised. And so you need to be careful as to, you know, especially if you're investing in a company that is likely to go into liquidation, likely to be stressed, to see what is the composition really of creditors, and to see whether there is enough covenants and enough hold that the related party or the unsecured creditor are not allowed to have, that you have the ability to control that process. I think you know, these are some of the concerns, issues that we face. There are other concerns, especially for an operational creditor. Now, an operational creditor can also file a bankruptcy petition, but the process is a little different for them as opposed to a financial creditor. Because vis-a-vis an operational creditor, you have to ensure that there is no real dispute in regards to the debt claim. And therefore, you know, if there is a dispute, that creditor will not be able to proceed with the bankruptcy petition. So, how does the operation creditor really, you know, crystallize its debt? It also requires certain certifications from financial institutions to ensure that its debt is crystallized, which we understand, you know, banks and financial institutions are not really willing to provide those certifications. And therefore, there is a little bit of concern as to how an operational creditor can actually, you know, go through this entire process. Having said that, I think it's the first time that a court actually permits an operational creditor to even to have such a power. But these are sort of saving issues that are being faced by operational creditors. I think, in a nutshell, these are the concerns on which more the statutory challenges that we face, in this process.
Thank you, Simone. I think the audience will be very benefited by identifying what are the pitfalls so that they can avoid it whenever they are going through this process or they are advising their clients through this process. Let me jump to Vyapak and take on his word that he's going to talk about some of the litigations right up to the Supreme Court. Vyapak, how can we use this bankruptcy court strategically? And, you know, can you tell about the litigation you talked about earlier in light of various different precedents which have come up?
Sure. So, as we mentioned earlier, right, though this court came pretty late last year in December 2016, and we are still in November 2016, in which we had clarifications, we have now an ordinance, but there has been a huge amount of litigation. I would not say jurisprudence in that sense, because it's still evolving, and people are grappling with the matters as to how to deal with it. But there are three or four large aspects which came up, and some of them have been settled by the Supreme Court, some of them have not been settled by the Supreme Court, and the questions are kept open, so there will be more debates, more discussions around it. So just to break this into two or three different topics, I think the first part which Simone touched upon is the whole issue of dispute, in sense, is your debt disputed or is it not disputed? There has been a bit of litigation around this, and there were few conflicting views taken by different NCLTs and different forums, some of them in form of appellate courts. But ultimately, I think the view emerging at the moment is that it's not a very strict interpretation, in sense that the dispute has to be in form of a dispute pending in courts. But even if you have raised the dispute timely, at least before the notice of demand or notice under the insolvency code has been issued, and if you can show that that was a genuine dispute raised before the issuance of demand, though there may not be a pending proceeding in relation to that dispute, I think so far as operational creditors are concerned, that should be, this issue is wide open, because at one end, this act is getting interpreted very, very strictly by the forums at NCLT, but it gets a little more wide interpretation as it goes higher in the on the forum at NCLT and the Supreme Court. So that is something which one needs to be, you know, careful about when you apply under this. Second issue comes out is on the issue of Limitation Act. And this is a very interesting point, because one would not think, in 2017, we are still debating as to Limitation Act would apply or not apply on certain kind of proceedings, because these are, I would not say these are new remedies. It's just a new law where some of the existing manner and process and forums have now got consolidated into one. As we know, binding law was there. This is an insolvency. In the insolvency code, there was BIFR, and now there is resolution or restructuring under the insolvency code, and all of that coming into one forum. But on Limitation Act, there are judgments which talk about it. Says the act doesn't say that Limitation Act applies, and therefore it doesn't apply. There are judgments also to say the act doesn't say that Limitation Act doesn't apply, therefore it should apply. Some judgments take a neutral way to say, though it doesn't say that it doesn't apply, but some of the other provisions suggest that it should apply. And when all of this went up to the Supreme Court said this issue is kept open and returned back the whole matter to the forums. But I think the objective of Limitation Act was a couple of things. One, you don't want a person who is sleeping over his rights too long to come and then exercise at some point in time. So there has to be a limitation on everything. You don't want people to just, you know, come at any given point in time. Two, you also need certainty in business. Yes, that was you. Yes, default happened. But if someone doesn't take action for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, how do you do your business? How do you put things into place if you elections and things like that. But I think it was also the objective of limitation act was also to bring certainty on those actions. So I think someday it will get fully resolved. But I think more and more judgments are coming on the aspect that there has to be some way of applying limitation act. One judgment came that it will apply from the day the act came into force. So even if it is a 1980 default or 1980 or 1950, but you still have 3 years because your right accrued on the day insolvency code came into play. Some people said there is no end to any limitation because limitation act is applicable, is not written in the act. So I think these are the some of the contradictory acts, but I think more and more things look favorable to the aspect of application of limitation act. I think it's only a question of how do you, resolve this conflict.
Yeah, I think another judgment suggested that every day of default, it's a continuing sort of...
So there's
no
end to it.
Every day.
But that aspect was taken care of in a winding up situation because this was also a case that can you apply 50 years, right? Because it's you have defaulted and it continues. Every day you have defaulted. So every day 3 years start. But I think that at least was already resolved that 3 years from the cause of action, if you don't do it, even binding up cannot be fine. So I think some of those things, and I doubt if this ordinance will address this issue, but I'm sure at some point in time this will get addressed.
The Mother Act, the Companies Act does face the limitation.
The third point which I think Michelle and Simone both touched upon is this whole... and that also has left open a lot of questions. Now, this is not a new concept, right? When you, though it was applied limited to certain kind of undertakings under BIFR, but moratorium was a concept which was understood under Section 20 and 21 of the CICA. Same thing applied when company was appointed a provisional liquidator or a liquidator, that you can't go against the company in that sense. So it's not a new concept. But it has come up in a very different way because the moment the admission is admitted in 14 days, the moratorium starts applying. And the moratorium is so wide that it says you can't even enforce your security interest, even under subset C or otherwise. So everything stops. But whether it applies to a guarantor, again, as I said, when it goes to courts, Allahabad High Court has interpreted it more purposively to say, if you want to stop everything against the company because of that debt, even corporate guarantors should be insulated. In that case, it was individual guarantors, but it should extend to any guarantee in that sense. While NCLT has taken a very, very strict interpretation that no, it only applies to the debtor, the corporate debtor, and therefore anybody outside corporate debtor, a parent or a corporate guarantor, maybe a third-party guarantor, you can still go ahead and go against them. But Allahabad High Court, as I said, has taken a little different view. So that issue is still open and you need to take care of that point as and when it goes further. So on whom it applies is an issue so far as moratorium is concerned. With situations, I think it's much more widely accepted that it is much wider in sense. Rather than narrow interpretation. How long? The law, at least the court specifies that it will apply till the time the process of resolution is complete, which is 180 days. But then there is an appeal as well. So question is, you are in an appeal against the resolution plan while moratorium is gone. So what happens? You will see a lot of litigations while the appeal process is on. This is something which needs some amount of deliberations. And not only that, I think what Nishal mentioned, right, that resolution plan is approved, moratorium goes, so either it is under appeal or no appeal, but you have taken over a company and then you will find all the litigations coming on you, which obviously were not initiated at the time when the resolution, so you can't even envisage who all will file appeals, right? How can you envisage what are the issues or what are the disputes unless there are dispute notices at the time of you do your due diligence, which is impossible to ascertain. So I think that again, as to how much you are insulated as to the title of the company or the issues or the businesses that you have bought, as to where it stops, right? And if you buy and then suddenly you have third-party suits by related parties from promoters and all, this process may happen for some time, but bad examples can obviously lead to this act again failing in its own sense. The third point was whether you need an approval of the shareholders. I think that was an issue when the board came in, but now it's been clarified that you don't need the approval of the shareholders. So that at least to some extent has been clarified through the process as we go along, but that is something which also shows that they just want to keep everyone outside except the committee of creditors, which is just the financial creditors. So it's all about financial creditors to restructure the company or take it to insolvency and nobody else. So that itself is a little different way in which we would need some of this restructuring which would happen as part of this. And I think settlement is something which Simon has already touched upon, that Supreme Court has in fact a petition which allows settlement and said that, look, these things should not keep coming back to us because people are going back and every time going to Supreme Court to get a settlement approved because they say NCLT has no power to approve a settlement. So I think Supreme Court has already guided, in some given a guidance to the appropriate authority to bring necessary changes. Then some of the situations can be tackled at the forum level rather than people being forced to go to Supreme Court for just approving the settlement after the petitions are ready. So this is where I think some of the mediations are going. And again, it's a treat for the lawyers, but I guess things need to be resolved much more swiftly by bringing in the guidance rather than going from forum to forum on some of these issues and iron out these issues.
Thank you, Vyapa. But it clearly, till government brings them, things become clear. What is clear right now is that legal advice on how do you, what is the position and how do you use it, this particular thing strategically, becomes very critical whenever one is involved in this particular process. Thank you. You know, I was reading an article by Harvard Business School on how Chapter 11 has brought, has helped U.S. economy and helped the revival of many, many companies. Similarly, this particular similar code would have helped in other countries also. What we would like to know from Nishal is how does our law compare to laws, similar laws in other jurisdictions? And Nishal, we have just 5 minutes.
Sure.
If you can complete, you can open for Q&A.
Sure. I think one of the points which Simon mentioned is a big criticism of the court is that the promoters, they don't have any role once the insolvency process starts. So the IRP takes over complete control over the day-to-day management of the company. Now, if you see the way U.S. bankruptcy code works, especially in Chapter 11 type of situation, once the insolvency process starts, the management continues to run the day-to-day affairs of the company. But there is a trustee which is the bankruptcy judge and the creditors to oversee the functioning of the company by the promoter or the controlling shareholder or the management. There is also investigation which can be initiated by the bankruptcy judge and the company in case it is found out that the management is siphoning off funds or, you know, stripping the assets from the company. Now, this is a big issue from an Indian perspective because I think it is a live situation. We did one transaction about 6 to 8 months back in a company which was in CDR, not under the insolvency code. It was under CDR. And I can't think of that transaction getting closed without the involvement of the promoter. The promoter negotiated with more than 30 lenders on the haircut. Almost on a daily basis, there was a negotiation call with the lender, you know, how it should be adjusted. The promoter negotiated with the investor who was bailing out the company out of the CDR process. The promoter at the same time was also managing, and this was a microfinance company where, you know, almost on a daily basis, the promoter had to stay in touch with the local distributors or the local guys who are lending to poor people. Now, in this type of business, there is no way you can think of an IRP taking over the promoter's place, where IRP will be able to, you know, continue the business in the same way as the promoter did. We are talking about a 180-day period, which could be extendable by another 90 days. But in a microfinance company, which is an NBFC, more than 90 days, if the loan is not repaid, it becomes an NPA. Now, if the promoter is not at helm of the operations, you will start seeing defaults happening from the borrowers. Now, once that happens, then, you know, you are actually depleting the value of the company further by not allowing the promoter to participate in the affair. So, I think one interesting thing in US is, you know, to fail is not a crime, but to fail dishonestly is a crime. I think what has happened in India is that all the promoters have been painted with the same brush. There could be genuine situations where, because of the way the industry operates or some major event has happened in the industry, there is a meltdown, there is a impact on the business of the company, because of which a genuine promoter with all good intentions has not been able to run the company. These type of situations are not frowned upon in the US. And actually, there are mechanisms where, you know, the court helps the promoter or the management to come out of this situation by giving protection from the creditors and the lenders. But unfortunately, we don't have this situation in India. And in fact, today's ordinance adds to that blow, where now completely the, you know, promoters and, you know, willful defaulters have been barred even from bidding for the assets which belong to their own companies. Second important difference which Indian bankruptcy code has from U.S. bankruptcy code is that in the U.S. bankruptcy code, when an acquirer acquires any asset, he gets a clean title to the asset. Now, this is a huge benefit compared to what we have in India. There is no clarity whether when an acquirer acquires assets or shares of a distressed company which has already gone through insolvency process, whether the title to the asset will be clear. As Vyapak mentioned, after the moratorium is over, there is no stopping any of the creditor or any of the parties from filing a suit or an appeal on the transaction which has happened. So this is another difference that we have, which obviously, if there was a clean title type of concept which would have come in, it would have given a lot of comfort to the international investors, especially who are willing to put in billions of dollars in India in stressed asset space. As far as the UK-India code is concerned, I think a couple of differences which we have is, in UK also, we have a concept of insolvency professional. Just like we have IRP, they have insolvency professional. The powers given to insolvency professional are substantially more than the powers which have been given to IRP. So if you see, there is a section under our insolvency code where for 12 to 15 things, the insolvency resolution profession still needs to go to the committee of creditors before it takes any decision. There is no such requirement under the UK bankruptcy code. The insolvency professional has complete powers. He can pretty much do whatever he wants, as long as he's not acting in a fraudulent manner. And I think the other difference for a change, India is better than UK on this, is there is no timeline for insolvency resolution under the UK bankruptcy code. We have 180 plus 90 days, which is the timeline within which everything has to get done. Although there is a criticism to that also, because if you are not able to finish the insolvency, the resolution process in 270 days, by default, the company goes into liquidation in India. So one of the criticisms to this is that because there is a very small timeline of 270 days, this could actually force the IRP and the committee of creditors to enter into fire sale type of situation, which may not give the best price for the assets of the company. So I think these are some of the differences which are there between the US, UK, and the Indian bankruptcy court. And I hope I have met with the 5 minutes timeline.
Yeah, I think we are just about a minute over schedule, but that's great. Compared to 270 days, how delays are happening in the Indian court. Okay, so with that, let's turn over to audience for questions.
Maybe Vaibhav, we can first take questions from the audience who have joined on phone, and then we can take it from the audience
here. So maybe start the question answer session.
Yeah.
So thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on the touchtone phone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Participants on the audio bridge to ask a question, please press star and one.
Maybe while we are waiting for audience to ask questions, any questions from the audience present there?
Suppose there are, if there is an asset in a particular company which has some licenses or some approvals which are for that. But when we go through the NCLT, the company will change. Will the license move with clarity on that, or can NCLT direct the authorities to transfer the license? Because the value will change drastically.
There is no clarity. And this happens largely in the manufacturing, particularly pharma and others, where you have licenses attached to the company. And therefore, it is very important that you take the company rather than the assets. And in those situations, I think restructuring will have to happen in the form and manner where you
just in real estate companies.
Real estate.
While that provision is there for mergers, demergers under Companies Act, I mean, earlier 391 to 394 and now 232 to 236, where the contracts or licenses of the transferor company automatically get transferred to transferee company. Whether for bankruptcy type of situations, I don't think there's any specific provision which has been incorporated, because the bankruptcy code came much later than the company act. Came in December 2016, whereas company act came in 2013. I don't think there is any subsequent amendment which has come in the company act to factor these type of situations, what you are saying, in place of slump sale type of situation.
Yeah, and in fact, the code itself says that the resolution for a plan cannot contravene any other law enforcement. Which means that you have to take into consideration other laws and requirements to actually form a plan. So it's be difficult to say that it's a blanket approval.
I think you had a comment.
Yeah, just to follow on that, you know, you said manufacturing. Actually, that is true of, the project also. Again, there's no clarity, although in most of the cases, the government is the counterparty. Yeah. And specifically, you know, issues like where the underlying land is, say, on lease from the government, long lease from the government, and there is no procedure, without taking the government approval, in which case, does this approval have to be obtained before the resolution plan itself, because, you know, as a bidder, one wouldn't know, what is the complication which would be arising, or in your experience, this is normally stipulated as a condition precedent for the bidder.
Yeah. It would be, so I think typically the way this process is work is the IRP along with the creditors committee will invite various bids, and the bids could be completely different. Some bidder may just want to acquire the shares of the company. Some other bidder may want to acquire a particular business of the company. Some third bidder may just want to acquire a plant of the company. So stipulating some of the things before the insolvency process starts may not be possible. Finally, whichever bidder is winning the bid, there will be a share purchase agreement or a business transfer agreement that will be entered into with that bidder. And this will be one of the, you know, before we close the transaction, you have to get approval from the government as a counterparty.
This doesn't form part of the 270, right? So this will go over.
This will go over.
Yeah, because at least the plan is approved.
Plan is approved. 270 days for approval of the plan by NCLT.
whoever is asking question, can you just identify yourself and your company name for people in on the phone?
This is Harish Doshi from KPMG. So I have two set of questions. One from potential bidder or a buyer perspective. How to assess claims which are, so one which are admitted is fine, you know, it's what about the claims which are either say on the book, but nobody has claimed it actually. You know, say or claims which are not admitted or, you know, any other thing. So how to assess those, you know, liabilities, that's one. And second, how, you know, most of this concerns about liabilities or litigation can be covered through a seeking an NCLT waiver.
So I think first question is can easily be answered. One is, after the IRP is appointed, he does put a publication, right, and invites the page. Now at that time, if you are not vigilant, and of course it's not that under law the claim falls, because if claim survives, it survives, and there can be litigations around that as well. But I think to some extent there would be an answer to say that, look, you were invited to ask for your monies or whether you had a claim or not claim, and you were not vigilant enough. So people who then acquire as a bona fide purchaser, right, the concept will come back to say that acquirer should be insulated from those claims unless they are such claims which the causation itself arises after that. Or if law allows him to take over it for 2 years, 3 years, and then come, maybe you will have to fight it out. And that happens in every acquisition, right? It doesn't mean only under the insolvency. Even in a normal slump sale or a normal transaction in a PEM in a deal, those things happen. So I don't think it in itself is a different you know, remedy. But I think you are in a better situation because you can say that, look, I as a purchaser gave you a chance. Now you can't come back because I am a bona fide purchaser and you are a third party claimer. So you are better off, in fact. And if you can, second question,
how, you know, how these NCLT waivers or support can be, you know, there.
So
for
NCLT doesn't have too much of power.
Yeah.
Because in fact it is the IRP who has to approve or disapprove, and any other person who is aggrieved can challenge.
So let me reframe my question. So what I meant was, say, for example, in my plan, I would be seeking, you know, delaying payments to a income tax department. You know, so can that be worked out?
No, because committee of creditors, maybe they will call those people if they feel it is important to get income tax to represent in one of the meetings and agree or disagree. Maybe they would try and CLT can't.
During the first order of synergy, there was an extension of payments to, you know, income tax department. And income tax department, I guess, obviously fight out. So where does all this situation stand? Or
no, I don't think that powers are there under the Act, right? And those situations would continue to remain. Yes, under the insolvency code, at least there is a great change from what it was to what it is today. But that is post-liquidation, because earlier government debts and government use were much ahead of the unsecured creditors and other things. Now at least those are much lower in the rank so far as insolvency is concerned. But as part of restructuring, I think you have to take that as part of the business rather than worry about delay or otherwise, or you privately negotiate. But there is nothing that SCLT can do.
Yeah, I have
Should we take now a few questions from the audience on the phone?
We have got one question on the bridge from Sanjini Saha from Cadwalder. Please go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was asked already. That's fine. Thank you.
A reminder to participants on AudioBridge, you may press star and one to ask a question.
Okay, let me, you know, I'm Jairov from Amber Flowers CRC. So, two questions I have. One is, in this whole process, who is the seller? You know, is the IRP the seller? COC is the seller? NCLT is the seller?
company is, who is the seller, the buyers are identified.
Company doesn't lose its identity, right? What is happening is IRP is only taking over the management of the company.
Okay.
So there is no change so far as the seller
the
buyer.
Sale process will be handled by IRP.
Who signs the sale purchase agreement is to be signed?
On
behalf of the agreement, is the IRP signed or the COC signed?
I think it would be a resolution process as a plan which is approved by NCLT, right? So that approval in itself is in some form.
So it's a judgment which comes from NCLT and that itself.
That in itself, because it's all happening as part of a plan which is approved by the NCLT. So that's. That is your ultimate. It's like your restructuring plan, even in cases of your
But let's go back to, for example, you know, surface.
No,
let me complete the second question. No, I have two questions.
No worry. No worries.
The second question is, in this whole scheme of things, where LCLT is a process, I think people need to understand there are two parties to this. One is, you know, the primarily the process is to be assigned by the committee of creditors. You know, what is their understanding of all these issues, like whatever issues are being raised, you know, do the creditors committee understand? So they are the people who have to run this whole process. I think giving too much of, you know, I think focus on the IRP or the NCLT process, finally the decisions are to be taken by the committee of creditors. They have to really give the comfort to the buyer.
But that is not anything different than what it was. I think what insolvency court brings it. So that's why we gave a little context, right, in our discussion. It's not that this is unheard of or it is never prevalent or even in our provisions because it was all scattered and therefore it was not coordinated and it never yielded that result which ultimately the objective was. Committee of creditors concept was there as part of BIFR. Committee of creditors concept was still there as part of JLS. Or lenders committee and things like that, right? Surface is also, the creditors have been given powers to just take over and sell it. I think what is happening under the insolvency code is restructuring is combined with insolvency. So try restructuring or go insolvent, but do it in a time-bound manner. Because what was the problem was the time taken for all this. Not that it was not happening. And because the time taken and with the conflicting forum, nothing was getting achieved. So now, maybe the pendulum has shifted from too much time to too little time, but maybe it was a disease which required that kind of a hard surgical method, and someday some balance will be drawn on that. But yes, that's where we are.
That is not the point. The point in the earlier context, whenever a restructuring or a sale or no, a merger or a takeover happens, it always used to be lenders used to play a limited role. Their role was not the kind of role what they are supposed to be playing in NCLT. NCLT, they are the guys who are really running the process.
No, not
the
really.
Process, the decisions are just taken by them.
Not really, actually. The creditors will continue to be as they are today. A host of covenants in any lender document. A host of covenants that require lender consent. So the insolvency code does not really require for the lender to physically manage the company. In fact, it's the IRP that is vested with the powers of the board. The board now has been replaced by IRP. The management has been replaced by IRP. The resolution has to come in from somebody else other than the IRP and given to the IRP and then presented to the committee of creditors. Nothing has really changed from perhaps from maybe a BIFR process.
Because BIFR also
similarly,
banker.
The creditor only supervises and takes care of financial issues. The process is run, everything is run by the IRP. So the committee of creditors is only there to approve or disapprove what is presented before them. So I think the equation has not really changed. It's just that the equation has maybe expanded to include other creditors in the committee to take care of decisions. But the proposal doesn't come from the committee. It is run by the IRP.
In fact, you know, we did this CDR deal where, as Vyapak mentioned, not much has changed from CDR versus an insolvency process. What happened in that deal, the lenders wanted to get their loan back.
you know, it was almost, I mean, all the loans were NPAs.
Promoter used to take back all the proposals. So there was a PE proposal, there was a strategic guy proposal, there was another refinancing proposal from a fund. He took all the three proposals to the lenders. Lenders looked at those proposals and they took a view that let's go with the PE because the other two proposals, strategic, we are not too keen, they will take time. Refinancing, want to revive the company. So let a PE come with equity and then, you know, we can then later on look at refinancing. Now this decision, they're all ultimately taken by lenders. The promoter was submitting all the proposals to the lenders. They evaluated all the proposals. They knew exactly which proposal is good, which proposal is not good. Ultimately, they know they want to get their money back and how fast to get their money back, right? Now, what is happening here now is in CDR, what promoter was doing here, IRP is doing.
Or
in
or the resolution applicant.
Or
any
yeah.
third party applicant.
Correct. So, creditors are, I mean, most of them are seasoned with these things, given that there are so many NPAs. So, they are going through these processes on divestment and, you know, what's the best way to end this.
And the likelihood is that the same credit will be there on some other borrower as well, in the same capacity.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Nathan. I'm independent from practice. Can you give a list of documentation which is normally will be entered by a potential investor taking over the asset, and particularly with reference to the bank, which are the pointed documents will be entered into. And since you mentioned that there is nil scope for indemnity, can there be a scope of indemnity from the
banks of here? Okay. So, answer to last one is no. But as far as documentation is concerned, see, there will be two sets of documentation. One is for the acquisition, and second is for settlement with the lenders. So, as far as acquisition documents are concerned, depending on whether you are acquiring shares or assets, if you are acquiring shares, there will be a share purchase agreement. If you are acquiring assets, there will be a business transfer agreement or asset purchase agreement. Then there will be a settlement agreement with the lenders on whatever haircut they are taking. And that will detail out all the, there will be escrow agreements which will be there because the moment the bidder puts in money, acquirer puts in money into the company, they don't want the promoter to siphon off that money. So the money goes into escrow account and from escrow it goes directly to the lenders. There is a concept of TRA account which is there. So broadly it's the acquisition documents and the which will be there.
So bankers will have no
problem. Bankers will just say a title of shares is fine and give me my money back.
Situation where a company is public and it's a multi-division company and one division is doing very well.
Yes.
And it wants to be carved out or there's a strategic buyer with interest in does this become an EGM kind of issue where the shareholder permission structure needs to be required, even though it's fine with the back of the road?
No,
there's like conflict of interest also.
Correct. Like the other part, I mean, this is a concern that was raised at the time the court was first came into court. So whether you require the approval of the shareholder to make decisions for the corporate position land set up. And the response to that is that the court did not envisage that. Does not envisage that. So once that's been agreed to by the financial services, that is it. You don't require the approval of, even if it's under the Company Act, you require that approval. This over supersedes that. And you don't require an additional approval.
Assuming that the valuation given to this is not fair.
In that situation,
yeah,
any agreed person
can
go ahead and appeal
the
there
is a recourse. But the recourse is on very, very limited grounds.
Right.
As to whether the process was not followed, there are only two or three grounds on which the appeal can be filed. Because they obviously won't want everything to get appealed in an immediate context, irrespective of what you do, everything gets appealed, right? At least the code restricts the grounds for appeal. And it's a narrow scope. But I'm sure people will find a way to get into it.
Irregularity in the process and evaluation, you know, is completely not
taken into consideration. Well, creditors, there isn't any money coming in. All good division is always welcome. So there's going to be a conflict of interest.
Right.
Yeah.
it's not very simple. With creditors also we have a problem because, you know, there is a certain creditor who has got a security of that particular asset. If it is sold and you can distribute it to everybody, he becomes unsecured,
right.
Frankly, you know. So, no,
you
will be disadvantaged now.
Now
so,
no,
how much do you want to
handle
that?
So, how his score has been.
So you have the option of increasing the security of the
Other
two small questions. First is on that Supreme Court discretion to withdraw the application. Suppose lender has filed the application, 14 days are over. Given the quantum of work with the NCLT, they might take 2 months and this has not been admitted yet. Can the lender withdraw the application at one time? Will there be suppose the lenders are taking a haircut, will they have the right to recompense the NCLT process?
I think you'll have to look at the insurance, right, whether it can be called or get or anything, because of option rights against you. So, I mean, it's not so simple because the code is, you know, expands the definition of poor creditor. So, I mean,
so you can join the queue, basically.
We'll have to look at what's
the
value.
Yeah, depends on, I mean, one is as an equity instrument. With equity instrument, you can't claim yourself as a financial creditor. In fact, in one situation, we're also trying if the financial investor is compulsorily convertible debenture. And we are trying to position him as financial creditor, right? Now, technically, CCD is equity from a FEMA perspective. But it's still debt in the books of the company. If you look at the balance sheet of the company, debenture appears in borrower's fund, not in shareholder's fund.
So we also did for the FCC, right? So FCC holders, like we said, there are so many remedies, right? But nothing works. But at least as an FCC holder, you are a bondholder, you have still not converted. So it is fully convertible. And definitely if you have already sent a notice for redemption, then it's a debt, and that was one of the first matters that we did, and we could at least get the IRP appointed, and if not recover the money, but at least make a point that this is not right. So yeah, there are some remedies which were not available earlier, have now suddenly propped up this. So it's a great move, I would say, as part of the process, because this is now consolidating everyone's thought into one forum and see if that can work for everyone or all the stakeholders. But to that extent, there are other issues which will crop up. So I think we'll see how it works.
And the last question was on the right of recompense for the lenders. Like, they have taken a haircut, NCLT gave a resolution plan implemented.
It's
it is not a negotiated thing, it is a binding thing.
75% done. Yeah. So, two short questions. My name is Vikram Mehta from Edelweiss. The first one is, what happens to the step-down subsidiaries, which are operating companies, of a company which is in NCLT, admitted? And the second question is, in any team, there are 3 to 4 years of assessments which are ongoing, either in income tax or in tax. So those liabilities are not yet crystallized, neither they are contingent liabilities. How do you deal with that?
That's the first. With respect to the subsidiary, that means the law says that NCLT can't go into the assets of the company. That's protected.
Neither the moratorium applies to them. They work like they, whatever they are.
Correct. However, the shares held by the holding company, the assets of the holding company, therefore, that can be disposed of. But the assets of the subsidiary itself remain as well.
So the shares held by the corporate debtor in insolvency, that share is
an
asset. So moratorium applies to those shares. If those shares are pledged, you can't do anything about it. Or if those shares are sold, you have to sell those shares. So subsidiaries may go up, right? But functioning of the subsidiaries are not.
And the asset of the subsidiary, for instance, if you are a shareholder in the subsidiary, you continue to be a shareholder in the subsidiary and no recourse against those assets.
It doesn't
work like the FTI situation where, you know, there was a concern, there was charge for the subsidiary that is going to be the minimum.
And the second question, I think, goes back to his question as well.
What is unknown is unknown.
Yeah, I think we'll have to leave with it, right? Because this is not a situation, it's like a transaction. It's only happening while you get a 6 months of cool-off period where you can do the transaction. Otherwise, companies in a distress, it's in default. People used to do transactions, right? It's not that transactions
were
not happening.
You have doing diligence. You have that detailed opportunity.
No, but then
the opportunity is there. But Section 29 of Bankruptcy Code specifically mandates that IRP has to make available all the information. There's only a listed company type of situation where UPSI and all those issues might come out
available
No, but correct.
Yeah.
But what we are saying is in it's not that in distress situation under insolvency code you can't do diligence. He has to provide all the information, financial statement, everything
but
mentioned.
Say you did the and you found that assessments are pending.
You can't do it.
Whether you are in an insolvency situation,
or in a
you are in a default
situation,
or in a normal situation, you take a call, right? But as part of the
here you just have to build in the risk and put in your pricing, factor in your pricing.
Correct.
Here, not do much compared to what remedies you will have in a normal transaction.
So when you are getting to IRP, you can always ask for your like income tax 283 certification.
281.
Whether they give or not, that's a separate thing.
The income tax will not give.
IRP,
they
have to work it out.
Just to add, there's a criminal liability on the company managerial position holder if they interfere with the IRP work.
Correct.
So there's a lot of deference in the company. But still, since I have worked from one account of just 12 days, but I found like there is a lot of repulsion from the existing managerial people disclosing the information.
Right.
There's always a conflict, right? There is no certainty of them being...
Do you think there can
I think if more can be done to
mitigate the situation and bring something like corporate whistleblower sort of thing and give immunity to a guy who can bring out more black holes?
I don't know, but I think we can always do that. But I think
the law is obviously pending for a long time.
Yeah.
Not talked about it.
So
the different subjects altogether. But yeah, I think it's always more can be done. But I guess at the moment they are obviously responding very well to the requirements which we are looking at the moment. And this is a new thing which we have to embrace. And
also, if you see the way India is also matured, I mean, in early 2000s, a lot of people were complaining there are no M&As happening in India. Promoters want to keep their assets with themselves. They don't want to sell anything. Now we are in a situation where promoters want to get their assets, but they don't. But they can't get it. Government is not allowing them to participate.
So they're getting haircuts, massive haircuts.
So.
So maybe 6:30 we can keep continuing talking, but
maybe one question we can take, but then we can go to Lima, which is a cocktail.
There's a company and which also has a corporate guarantee. The corporate guarantor has not exercised the corporate guarantee. So while framing the resolution plan, will the debt of the corporate guarantor also be included?
Just to understand your question, I think what I'm trying to say, there is a corporate debtor who is the principal debtor. It's under the insolvency plan. I, as a creditor, also has a corporate
guarantee
from its parent or a third party. So, like we touched upon that issue, at the moment, there is an ambiguity whether a moratorium will apply to that corporate
In the claims.
But can I independently invoke my corporate guarantee?
Not yet.
That I can apply here. But as part of restructuring, right, that corporate guarantor has nothing to do with it. Because he is not a creditor, neither
he
is a
corporate
debtor being the guarantor.
No, but in
no,
that...
No, he says corporate guarantor is a third party.
Only
third
party.
It's an outside.
The corporate debtor is a guarantor for a third for another entity is also a corporate, which is not in the insolvency.
That
so that the management and the promoters don't do.
They want to
avoid to avoid the default situation. Rest remains as it is. So if there is a corporate guarantee given by the corporate debtor under insolvency, that guarantee obligation doesn't get evaporated, right? That guarantee situation remains. How you handle it as part of the restructuring plan is part of the creditors to handle it. Tomorrow, if somebody invokes that guarantee, the debtor under insolvency, right, gets moratorium only for 6 months.
That concludes this conference call for today. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.